Hello and welcome to the EMJ Health Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, where each week we discuss innovations to help elevate the quality of healthcare. Today, I'm joined by Sophia Mariva, Greater Good Breast Cancer Research Professor and Director of the Breast and Ovarian Cancer Risk Evaluation Program at Michigan Medicine. And this is the second episode in a two-part series. Last week, we covered Sophia's journey into medicine and some of her fascinating research. And this week, we'll be diving into AI in cancer treatment, among other fascinating topics. Welcome back, Professor Sophia Mariva.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I was fascinated, having been born in Britain and lived pretty much half my life in the United States. Why was vaccine uptake so poor in certain areas? And there was a political association. And as you and I both know, the vaccine hesitancy really comes from some fallacious work going back years about the association between MMR and autism. In breast cancer, I'm astonished to hear what you've told us, because women are much better health advocates for themselves than men. They're much better at dictating the dialogue and driving the dialogue. Men are bloody useless. So I'm astonished to hear that it's so low. Is it a lack of, you know, is it people who don't have the financial resources, or is it concern? Is it like vaccine hesitancy?
Well, there is, let me unpack. I mean, you said a lot of truths there. Let me unpack a little bit what I think. And, you know, I haven't studied this, so this is just speculation on my part. It's educated guess, is all. This is one, I think in general, the relationship between the drug and the chemical and the patient is something that the internet has been a double-edged sword for sure. So when I discuss tamoxifen, for example, with somebody who has a BRCA2 mutation, who is 35 or 40 years old, who wants to have one or two more children still, but doesn't want to get pregnant immediately, for example, then I would discuss the data with them and so on. And one of the things I would recommend is, if you go to the internet, I would recommend that you be aware and that people who are doing fine on tamoxifen, like I am, you know, I was talking to them and I was on tamoxifen myself. I don't go on the internet and say how great I'm doing. You know, only the overrepresentation of trouble on the internet has been in social media, a lot of people giving advice on Facebook. I read and I cringe the stuff people write with absolutely no knowledge. And it convinces their neighbors, because they are otherwise, you know, the person they know at the supermarket or the person, the other teacher in the school. You know, this cuts across educational levels. I see people with good secondary and university education who believe just random anecdotal things that people write on the internet. There are a lot of people in the world. And if most of what is written about the interaction between the drug and the person is written by those who have side effects, and then also, you know, the relationship to side effects is something that it all depends how you value prevention. I mean, prevention of a disease that is basically universally lethal, unless you take exactly the treatments that have been proven effective, that should be a no-brainer, right? But it is a brainer, because there are all these other people saying things that are completely out of context, but it's anecdotal. And the public in the United States has so little understanding of science, of statistics, of epidemiology, that it is very depressing at all levels. I think we need to really revamp K-12 education. I believe I had a much better education in a country that's not a high-income country like the United States, in Argentina. I have much better education in elementary school that prepared me for what I'm doing now, and at least to understand how to unpack science. The other thing is, there is this concern about drugs being chemicals that you put in your body. Of course, these are the same people, like all of us, that once in a while we've been known to, you know, eat a potato chip or something. You know, we are putting chemicals, anything that's processed, we are putting foreign chemicals in our body. So unless we are eating all pure foods that never saw a pesticide or any kind of processing all the time, we are putting all those chemicals in our body in great numbers. I just read that we all have microplastics in our blood circulating. So thank you so much for that progress. So, you know, so to put it in perspective, I think it's a failure of education at all levels. There is a political overtone, Jonathan, but you know, chance favors the prepared mind, right? Louis Pasteur said that. The politicians who are trying to deny science would not have a foothold in a society that is strongly affirmed on basic principles of this, the laws of nature. You know, it's just, if people trusted science and the sincerity of scientists who make all the life sacrifices to give society that those advantages of postponing losing life and postponing low quality of life for as long as possible, which is kind of what we're trying to do, I guess, in all of medicine, they wouldn't have a foothold. So we need to take responsibility. We really do. We cannot be just in the lab or even in our wonderful clinics. We need to get out there. And that's why I did do global health, and I wish I had time to do more. Because I think even somebody like me, it's one person in a team, of course, I always worked in teams, I think we made a big difference. And so more people should get involved in that, I think.
Yeah, your point about the internet is well taken. It's an echo chamber, and the algorithms on the internet, once you've taken, you know, you've searched for one thing, that's what you'll see.
Yeah,
and it reinforces either positively or negatively. I think we as doctors have to do a better job, but I agree with everything you've said. So here's a chance for you to wax lyrical, and you can take this any direction you want. You're a leader in the breast and ovarian cancer space. What advances are on the horizon to prevent, detect, and treat these malignancies globally? That's a huge question, so you can just take it wherever you want.
Yeah, so I believe we need to encourage industrialists, people with many billions of dollars, to invest on dissemination of essential medicines globally, or invest on encouraging businesses in America, in Europe, everywhere, small businesses to get involved in distribution of essential drugs. I mean, I think it's terrible that essential drugs that are very low cost, not to mention the high cost technologies, I'll talk about that in a second, but I think the distribution of essential drugs is what we need to push for. At the present time in Argentina, for example, with the current crisis, I am told that cancer patients are not getting their oncology drugs. That's unacceptable. I mean, that makes me want to go there with a suitcase full of drugs and see if I can get through customs. I'm sure I could, but I won't reveal how. So, you know, it's just unthinkable to me that people are hungry in Argentina right now and that cancer patients are not getting their drugs. So if that's correct, you know, again, I haven't verified it myself, but, you know, those kinds of crises are unacceptable. I've been to the cancer hospitals at the Gaza-Israeli border. I have been to cancer hospitals on the Israeli side. I've been to cancer hospitals in Lebanon, in Jordan, in Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco. You know, Arab populations have been one of my passions, to increase cancer care in North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. You know, I go anywhere where there is peace. I mean, I don't want to be shot at, of course, if possible. I'd like to make it home. But, you know, if there is peace, we can work. We need to take the high road. We need to really, really advocate for the profits to be controlled. Things cost in America. It's immoral what things cost. You know, I have busted my knee in Iceland. I have fallen other places in the world trying to do things that I shouldn't for my age. And you know, going on adventures, I should just not do, like dog sledding and things like that. And I have hurt myself. And then I have just paid for my treatment with a credit card. And yeah, sure, I tried to get refunded. But it wasn't, I didn't have to sell my house, or I didn't have to, you know, go on the food line to get free stew like people are doing in Argentina here right now, because I pay my medical bills, which is what happens to my patients. I have many patients who tell me, oh, doc, what prescription are you ordering? You know, I don't mind throwing up once or twice. You don't have to order the expensive drug for me. You know, that breaks my heart. You know, I just go to my bag and I see how much cash I brought. I don't want my patients to throw up. So it wouldn't be the last time. I just gave them the cash to pay for the copay for the drugs, which is ridiculous for somebody who's getting, you know, drugs that cause the nausea. And I have drugs to prevent it altogether so they can go to a movie or go out to dinner or enjoy life. That's what I'm doing, so people have good quality. So how come the nausea drugs cost so much? It's immoral. And so that would be my, you know, that's the direction I want us to go. I want us to say, you know, we are doing all the science. You need to help us get it to the people, to all the people.
Yeah. It's very noble. A changing topic yet again. I think I could talk to you all day, Sophia. Artificial intelligence, AI, it's a buzzword. In what ways are you and your team applying AI to your breast cancer research?
Oh, yeah, we are applying it all over the place because, you know, when we started with our brain niche device, the blood-brain barrier device, that was a great idea. But then the main engineer called Chris Oliver, who just a genius, who worked with me when he was a postdoc in my lab and then became a professor, he says to me, well, Sophia, we're going to have data on 20,000 cells. So what do you want me to do with that? And so this was about 2016, 2017. So nobody was talking about AI in medicine then. And I said, well, I don't know. Let's use AI. If Google can do it, why not us? So let's use AI to build a model to see what features of the cancer cells matter to predict whether they'll get into the brain. And, you know, you have to hand it to engineers. He didn't know any better. I mean, if anyone else would have thought, this is nuts. I mean, what are you talking about? And but he didn't have any bias because he's an engineer and he's happy to try it out. I'm fond of saying to people when I make these suggestions, you know, the computer is not offended. You know, if you try it out and it doesn't work, nobody will hold it against you. But if you don't try it out, you'll never know. So we tried it, and the models started giving us, you know, 97% accuracy, things like that from the get-go. You know, we didn't know what features of the cancer cells to look at. And in AI, you typically don't know. Like, what do you need to use to predict the future, to predict what's going to happen? In true AI, you don't know. The algorithm will find out for you. And so we guessed right, because, of course, we used some of the knowledge we had about cancer to make some guesses. But then we added a lot of things that we had no data on. You know, the shape of this particular shape of the cell, whether the cell squeezes itself or doesn't, how fast it moves, this. some obvious things we used, but there were other 14 variables. We had no idea if they would help. Then when we put them all together, we had 95, 97%. So I wasn't sure, is this good? I mean, since there were no other papers in the literature that had used AI to make any of these predictions, I couldn't compare it. I mean, I like 100%, but I know I wouldn't get that. And so then I find, then the first, so we published that. And then most papers with AI in medicine making predictions, they are very happy starting at 70%, which I don't think is that great. But, you know, I don't want to offend anyone. I know I wouldn't do very much if that's all I could get. I would just find another way. But, you know, that's just my bias. I want to be a little more accurate. I come from the physics world. So I don't like to do a lot of statistics. If I have to do a lot of statistics to extract the truth, I'm already a little doubtful.
Yeah, it's going to be a game changer. I mean, it used to be that in research, you had to be so careful about gathering too much data because people said, well, it's just a fishing expedition. Well, that's what we're doing now, basically. Yep. And instead of, I guess the analogy would be, apologies to anyone who's a fish lover out there, and I don't mean to eat. Classic research would be fly fishing, sight fly fishing, where you cast a fly to a given fish, whereas today we're dropping a stick of dynamite in the river and everything comes to the surface. I think it's going to be the next few years are going to be fascinating. By the way, someone pointed out to me that if one is a fan of science fiction, 2024 in the Terminator movies is the year that Skynet launched, which was the evil AI that led to the downfall of humanity. So, oops.
Okay, well, I'm not a scholar of the Terminator movies or The Matrix, which is the one most commonly quoted to me. You know, and so I'm not a scholar of those, but I respect it that, okay.
Well, you know, we've got to be cautious, but I'm also not a conspiracy theorist or biting my fingernails. So recently you presented some new research on the development of a precision medicine-based platform to guide the treatment of non-small cell lung cancers. Can you elaborate a little bit about that research and what are the next steps now after the results of this?
Well, we are so excited about that. That's what occupies 90% of my brain at the moment. Because this is the story, Jonathan. You know, we take cancers and we definitely want to advocate pretty much in all cancers to have the genes determined, right? To do next generation sequencing, we call that NGS for short, and to really find out targets, potential targets. But what's the problem with that? The problem is the math. You know, not every biologist is very good, doesn't think, I should say. They are very good in math, I'm sure, if you give them a math problem. But they don't think in mathematical terms the way, you know, computational biologists do, or engineers or physicists. So the problem is the math. You can only give one treatment at a time. Now, maybe not one drug at a time, but one combination of drugs or one drug at a time. You're not going to give 17 drugs to a patient, right? The body cannot withstand that. And so the problem is you get a lot of mutations. You get a lot of changes in a cancer that has progressed. So there are even more and more changes than there were at the beginning. And now you want to treat that cancer because the patient is in trouble. And so you are guessing because you don't have any kind of ranking of which target is more important than what target. Eventually, if we had millions of outcomes, then AI may help us with that. But we are not there yet. We may be in maybe 10 years. In that condition, but I don't think so. So what we try to do, and I decided this about 7 years ago, is we take the cancer and we kill the cells, extract the DNA, the RNA, and we do the sequencing. What about, you know, dead cells don't kill anybody. So I said, what about we keep some cells alive? They are the cells that were in the patient yesterday. Today, we plate them in very special ways that we designed. It took us years to get it right. that simulate, similar to what we did with the brain itch, that simulate how the tumor is in the body. And then we treat them in the dish with different drugs that the patient is likely to be suggested based on the molecular makeup or based on the type of cancer, based on anything, based on what they had before. You put it all together and you test those cells through a panel of drugs, maybe 10, 20, maybe 30 drugs. And then you give results within a week so that the patient can then rank with a doctor, with the help of the doctor, they can rank the drugs. Maybe two or three drugs have the same activity, but different side effects, and the patient can choose. Okay, I don't want to lose my hair. If they all seem to be equivalent in the number of cancer cells they'll kill, maybe I choose, you know, some other side effect or whatever. Those kinds of discussions can be informed by additional data on live cells that actually kill patients, because dead cells, again, don't kill patients, but that's all we study. We study dead cells. So I decided we're going to go for it. And the question is, when we say somebody's going to be resistant to cells, that's very important that we be right, because we would be denying treatment, right? Or they are less likely to receive that treatment if they take our test into account. And so it was very important for us to be right when we said somebody was resistant to medicines. And we find that we are nearly 100% right. I call it 99%. We haven't had any exceptions so far. If we have said that somebody is resistant to something, when we unblind, that was something they got before and they had already progressed on. So they are by definition resistant. Or if they went on to receive it, they didn't respond. Because at this point in time, we are not mandating any treatment. It's not being used commercially or anything. It's still research. We are slowly making the transition to being approved to return results. And the process is very arduous and very complicated, and it should be, because it's very important to get it right. And so we are now trying to understand, we understand the negative predictive value pretty well, but we need to understand the positive predictive value. And that will take longer time because people go on many different drugs. And so that's going to take time. And we are designing the clinical trials to understand that right now. So we are very excited. We think this is going to be a complement, not instead of, a complement to the molecular characterization of tumors. And it's going to benefit people, because a lot of people, it's just based on guessing. So hopefully we are going to do better than guessing.
That's wonderful. And we'll look forward to hearing more about it the next time we have you on. But sadly, we've come to the last question that I like to ask all my guests. If you were granted three wishes for the future of your area of healthcare, what would they be?
Equity, equity, equity. I can't stand the injustice. It keeps me up at night. I want to get up and try to do something. I can't cope with it, to be honest. So if it were that simple, that I have three wishes, I want all of them to be that. I want everyone to have the best access to the science, to the technology, to the opportunity. I think we owe it. I think we owe it to people historically. I think we need to have the historical perspective. I think we need to, because that's going to be the rising tide that lifts all ships, is to recognize that nothing is more important than equity.
That was very eloquently said, and why should I be surprised? Because everything you've said is eloquent, Sophia. Thank you for educating me, and I'm sure our audience. And thank you also for being so inspiring. You're clearly one hell of a woman and one hell of a scientist. And thank you for taking the time to speak with us, Professor Sophia Mariver, and frankly, for everything you're doing for patients living with cancer.
Thank you so much, Jonathan, and the whole team. I really appreciate this opportunity, and hope to talk to you in the future again.
Absolutely. When you've got new things to tell us about, just ping me an email and we'll have you back on. It'd be a delight. So everyone listening, please subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Check out the archives. There's lots of amazing guests like the good professor there. And please join us next week for another fascinating episode of the EMJ podcast. Until then, please, everyone, stay safe, stay well, stay curious. Bye for now.